So, okay, here's how it went down. On October 5th, Netflix released a new Dave Chappelle comedy special called The Closer, complete with a promo voiced by Morgan Freeman.
He looks as if he's about to say something. What could he possibly have left to say?
You shut up, Morgan Freeman!
Now, people tuned in to watch because, you know, he's Dave Chappelle. I mean, he's the comedian who brought us some of the most memorable comedy of all time. Now, in my very inexpert opinion, the Chappelle Show skit, I Know Black People, is quite possibly a perfect TV comedy sketch.
Why did black people distrust Ronald Reagan?
Because he was white?
That is correct.
Because he took all his money?
That is correct. Why did black people distrust Ronald Reagan?
He wasn't supposed to be trusted in the first place.
He is correct.
But when viewers tuned in on October 5th, they didn't get the edgy, sharp nuance of those unforgettable Chappelle Show skits. Instead, Dave Chappelle seemed angry, kind of whiny, small, and mostly, I think, just plain unfunny. Now, he did deliver punchlines in that unmistakable Chappelle tone, but The Closer, well, it sounds more like a rant than a routine.
It's not funny! It's not funny! It's not funny when you pull off an incredible caper! You thought you got over, next day you're in the paper! It's not funny.
And it's a rant with a clear target. Transgender people.
They don't hate transgender women, but they look at trans women the way we blacks might look at blackface. It offends them. Like, ooh, this doing an impression of me.
Seriously, y'all, Dave Chappelle was so singular in his unrelenting abuse of transgender folk that I started to think he was running for a seat in the Texas state legislature.
Oh, rim shot!
But to be clear, many loved it. On Rotten Tomatoes, Chappelle's The Closer had a 96% positive rating with ordinary viewers. Among professional TV critics, the rating is a measly 43% Rotten Tomatoes. And this gap for me, this is where it gets really interesting. So how should we understand this profound perceptual difference? By one reading, this is about an overthinking, out of touch, self-proclaimed, woke minority trying to impose unrealistic, politically correct discourse values on everybody else. But there's something else here. Cutting across this culture clash narrative of free speech, comedic artistry, political correctness, and elite discourse is an older and far more simple divide: race. It's possible to read Dave Chappelle's newest special and the uproar that has followed as a masterwork performance art project displaying both the limits and the reach of black male privilege. For example, Jacqueline Moore, a white trans woman and former showrunner of the hit Netflix series Dear White People, said she would no longer work with Netflix as a result of their decision to release and defend The Closer. As a result, Moore has received personal, vile, and violent anger and abuse in social media. And much of it is racialized. And if you want kind of a summary, it gets simplified something pretty close to, how dare a white woman, cis or transgender, speak against a black man? Even if he is a multimillionaire with a massive global platform, as a black man, he's inherently endangered, and the criticisms of a queer white woman are inherently invalid. It's an argument that Chappelle anticipates in the special and delivers as a punchline.
You know, a lot of the LGBTQ community doesn't know the baby's history. He's a wild guy. He once shot a nigga and killed him in Walmart. Nothing bad happened to his career. Do you see where I'm going with this? In our country, you can shoot and kill a nigga, but you better not hurt a gay person's feelings.
So do you see what he did there? By this logic, there are black people and there are queer folk. And in a nation where the lives and labors of black people are ignored, maligned, and endangered, black folk have free rein to ignore queer folks' pleas for humanity, security, and justice.
It's not funny.
Which means Chappelle is not only guilty of mediocre comedy, he's guilty of bad logic. Because see, black folk and queer folk are not separate communities. They're overlapping, intersecting, and enmeshed. I'm Melissa Harris Perry, and that intersection is where we begin today on The Takeaway.
It's not funny!
We're talking with Araya Lester, Deputy Director of the Transgender Strategy Center. Araya, welcome.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So let's begin at the intersection of Black and queer identities. What are some of the specific vulnerabilities of Black trans women?
Oh, the Black trans women, I always say, are on the lowest rung of our societal ladder, not only here in America, but pretty much worldwide. When you're looking at the racial intersectionality, myself being a Black woman of trans experience, and I kind of say that because the Black comes first, right? Mm. That's the first thing that someone notices about a person is their physicality. And so the movement, the civil rights movement, is relatable to the LGBTQ movement. But in essence, even within that movement, the trans community is so far behind that in essence, it has become one of the oppressed communities that we saw within the prior to the 50s and 60s here in America for Black and African American communities.
It always feels to me like one of the most profound challenges of intersectional work in community is this question of the sources of violence and vulnerability. So for both trans and cisgendered Black women, there is vulnerability to state violence, right? Just as there is for cisgendered Black men. But there is also profound vulnerability to violence from Black people, from people in the community.
Mm-hmm. It's like our community is almost being mentally tricked, not by one entity or by one person, but by the retelling of certain stereotypes and paradigms that we see. One, our example of power since the institution of this country has been white, male, heterosexual, cisgender. And so this cis heteronormative type of look with that white overlay on it is what we as a people has always seen as the face of power. And so when you're looking at the direct opposite of all of those, the direct opposite of white is Black, man is woman, cisgender is transgender, you know, you just come down to the Black trans woman. And so you don't see as much violence against trans masculine individuals within the Black community, although it does happen. And I don't want to take away from the things that our trans masculine siblings go through. But yeah, there's almost like a reflex of, oh, you took away a piece of our power from as a community by identifying yourself as something that is directly opposite to what we see as power in America. And unconsciously, there's a backlash. And so we see a lot of interpersonal and community harm and violence against Black trans women in particular.
All right. Thank you so much for that insight. I've been puzzling over what is at stake. Like, as I watched the Chappelle special, I get, there's a part of me that was like, what is cultivating this anger? What is it that this person sees at being so at stake around the identity of Black trans women? But I feel like you just helped me to identify it, that it's about as though Black women of trans experience are pulling away the little bit of patriarchy or male privilege that exists within a still marginalized, you know, racial community.
Yeah. I mean, we don't see that with white trans women. You know, they don't go through the same violence and barriers from their own community, that because, you know, white people have it made. And so you have the first trans billionaire is a white trans woman, you know, And look at Caitlyn Jenner and just all of the privilege that just comes with that, with the racial ethnic type of identity. I see it in that person's eyes when they look at me when I'm in streets and I come across my community and have to hear hateful things. You know, it's almost like they take a personal offense. And where is that personal offense coming from? But from a lack of power and a lack of access.
This is also a moment when lawmakers, legislation is actually introducing new legal barriers, particularly for trans children and young people, you know, setting records for the number of anti-transgender bills that are being introduced. And I'm wondering about sort of these cultural moments like the Chappelle closer happening at the same time that this legislation is being introduced.
Well, we've seen this before. Back in the late 1800s, remember the minstrel shows? You know, they were a form of comedy that really stereotyped and lampooned and put down Black individuals in the Black community under the guise of comedy. And at that same time, there was a rhetoric being put out there that Black men were dangerous for your white women and for your children. And what are we seeing now? The exact same thing with trans individuals, to where we're used as the punching line and punching bag within comedy specials. And then at the same time, there's a fear-mongering that's being created politically and using the trans community as a scapegoat to kind of put pressure on the insecurities that we feel and the lack of knowledge that we have as a nation for trans people, the same way of what happened in the past with us as Black people. And I just don't see how people aren't seeing it.
Oh, Araya, what you just did there is so powerful, because that minstrel show or blackface, I mean, Chappelle actually describes the trans experience as though it is blackface and says, oh, it's about impersonating womanhood. And for you to invert that and actually show that, no, it's actually quite the opposite, right? It's about the vulnerability of bodies that are on the margins.
Yeah, and our bodies are the most vulnerable. You know, just a few years ago, the life expectancy for Black trans women was the age of 35, you know, and that's just due to murder and violence and high rates of HIV and sexual assault and murder, because of just our community is against us. Of course, society is against us. Even our own families are against us. So it just kind of all sets us up to not be able to even live long here.
I want to talk for a moment about Daphne Dorman, who Chappelle references directly. And as I hear you talk about the cultural and the familial and the community rejection, can you tell us a little bit about Daphne's story?
Daphne, well, there's a post by one of Daphne's best friends, Mia Satya, on Facebook, who I am friends with and spoke at the First National Trans March here in D.C. Daphne was a comedian who, you know, it seemed that Dave kind of utilized her, you know, for his own efforts and his own kind of claim to fame, in a sense. And as we see, Daphne's story was used by Dave in the last special. And not long after that, Daphne took her life. Unfortunately, we don't know the exact reason why, but the timing was very telling. And from what was told in that Facebook post, Dave Chappelle never reached out after the death, never sent any condolences, never did any type of acknowledgement until this special. You know, and to see exactly how Daphne has been portrayed, you know, after such a colorful and amazing life, and then such a horrible end to it, that I don't see how that storyline can be used in any type of way of comedy. And that's what we see, period, around the across the line for trans women. You know, our deaths are laughed at and overlooked. And there's a lot of victim blaming for everything that we do. And it's just really sad that, you know, Daphne was not someone that they felt the need to really, you know, address the death of, but yet you're going to use her story for something that's so hurtful and creates so much miseducation at a time that we're trying to educate the masses on what it means to be human, basically, you know, and what it means to have basic respect and empathy for each other and understanding that we're all individuals and we're all just trying to figure out ourselves within this life. And as a Black person, you know, trying to figure out ourselves and having to navigate a system that's not built for us. And what I think Dave is doing is just feeding into that system, you know, and not knowing that it was built by our oppressors and therefore it's not going to work for us. I think Frederick Douglass, when he talked about the Mitchell shows, he said that it was a way to pander to the corrupt taste of their white fellow citizens. And this is a pandering to the corrupt taste of America that we see now after our racial kind of George Floyd disputes and everything we've been through. And to come to now for Dave as a Black man to just take a community and just push them down even further and hold down our proverbial necks is just, I'm just really lost as to the whys.
Araya, you said something powerful here, many things powerful, but when you just said we're talking about what it means to be human. So what I want to do as we come to the end of our conversation, I want to pull back up to that humanity, which always means we are more than simply the sum of the oppressions that we survive. Talk to me about the work of the Transgender Strategy Center or about the joyous, beautiful community that you and so many other Black women of trans experience are building despite the hate.
Well, at the Transgender Strategy Center, you know, our goal is just trans liberation and specifically elevating the liberation of our Black family within our transgender, non-conforming, and non-binary communities because what we need is fighters, you know, and so we go out, we go to corporations and we help them learn what it really means to be human, basically. You know, we all come into this world kind of knowing what we're comfortable in, our clothing, our favorite colors, our favorite games. And then as we go through school and we go through society, we then learn what is expected of us that may be quite different to what we know is innate. And we all have that experience, trans or not. And so myself and my organization really tries to teach corporations on how to intertwine that within their rhetoric, within their policies and procedures and onboarding for employment, and also helping our community in building up leadership development, capacity building, technical assistance, and assisting trans-led organizations who are really helping those who, you know, are still facing that 35-year life expectancy and trying to make it to where we're able to retire and grow old. We're assisting them with grant making and funds and helping them just learn how to navigate this world to where, you know, you're going to have a lot of more Dave Chappelle specials and a lot more anti-trans legislation and just learning what we can do to combat it and to further educate America and the world into just becoming better people.
Araya Lester, Deputy Director of the Transgender Strategy Center, thank you for your work, your empathy, and your voice.
And thank you for yours, Melissa.
I want to switch gears just a little bit and talk more about comedy. Because I just want to say, I'm not at all against comedy that pokes fun at aspects of the transgender experience. Flame Monroe is a transgender Black comedian who I find hilarious. She reflects on potentially terrifying moments of transgender vulnerability, like being stopped by a traffic cop who is likely to ask for a driver's license, a license which will reveal a gender, a name that don't match her self-presentation. But Flame makes it funny, inverts the power, and still manages to teach us a little something about the challenges of living as a Black trans woman.
He said, excuse me. I said, I'm sorry, officer. Is there a problem? He said, yes, ma'am, you were speeding. I said, oh, I'm sorry, officer. I'm running late for work. I promise to slow down. He said, well, hold on, pretty girl. Hold on. I said, ooh.
See, this inversion, the surprise, this playfulness with the self, that is what I love in comedy. To help me think more about the comedic aspects of Dave Chappelle's The Closer, I talked with Mix Dahlia Bell, a writer and comedian who penned a letter in The Guardian to Dave Chappelle. It's entitled, Dear Dave Chappelle, transgender comedians can take a joke, but why are yours so unfunny? I asked Dahlia, what do you find funny? Like, what cracks you up?
When someone says something I have never heard before. It's the element of surprise. So you're bracing yourself for one thing, and then they throw this other thing at you. And especially if it's a perspective that only they could possibly give you, mm-hmm. I think is what makes a joke legendary.
Got it. I love that. And it's, you know, because I was trying to think about this myself, like, what do I find funny? And I think it's a little bit of both what you've said here, and this is, again, just for me, is both that I want it to be surprising, but also familiar, right? Like, for me, something probably cracks me up the most, I just think in my day-to-day life, when it's a little bit of an inside joke, but then also, like, a completely surprising spin on it. I probably actually can't find things funny if I have no reference point for them, right? So I like Southern jokes. I like Black jokes. You know, I like more and more these days, I like old lady jokes as I age. And I don't think in my 20s, I would have at all thought that, you know, jokes about your 50-year-old body were funny, but they're hilarious to me now.
You know, and I would agree with you, but I think one of the challenges for a comedian is being able to make the unfamiliar feel familiar. I mean, obviously, I'm coming at this from the perspective of a very, very queer comic. So it is a challenge that I had to overcome in order to do what I do. Because I have to make jokes that are written specifically for queer people, because it's the only context I have, funny and accessible and digestible for straight cis people.
When you're writing jokes, are you thinking of it that way? Or are you, again, I'm just sort of interested in the creative process. And let me explain in part why I'm sticking on this for a minute. I think I'm hilarious. I find myself very funny. And I will say that my beloved consistently tells me that I am the person who thinks that I am the funniest and that I should probably not laugh quite so hard before I even get the punchline out. So I'm wondering, like, when you're actually producing comedy and not just like basically singing in the shower, which is my version of comedy, like, what? How do you know you've hit it? You're like, yes, this is it. I've got this line right. I've got this delivery right.
Yeah. So for me, to be honest, my first priority is that I think it's hilarious. So I'm with you there. You know, every singer starts in the shower, right? But then once I'm laughing in my own house, then I have to go on stage, and I have a very specific strategy that I live by, where the moment I start performing, I look to find the audience member who likes me immediately, because I want them to continue liking me till the end of my set. And then I don't care how they feel. And then I want to find the person who likes me the very least. And if I hit a punchline and both of those people are laughing together, I win.
I love that. And I get that, right? I absolutely get, right? You want your, you want that audience member who's with you from the beginning and who's absolutely not with you. And if you got them both, then you've got it. That makes perfect sense to me. So I want to pivot just a little bit now to Dave Chappelle. Let's just start with something you told my producer, which was
a conversation.
I know, really. We'll come back to Pleasant in a moment. But you told my producer in part you didn't even want to watch this special. Can you tell me why?
I thought I knew what it was going to be. And I'm like, okay, Dave is going to say some stuff that's, you know, invalidating towards women. And he's going to go for, like, the cheapest trans jokes he can think of at the moment. So I just didn't need to. What I definitely didn't want to do, and what I have avoided doing for, let's see, he's been at this since 2017. So for the last 4 years, I've avoided responding to anything he has done because, like, right now, I think he owes me at least $3,000 in publicity. But yeah, I just knew what the special was going to be. I knew it wasn't going to be valid. I knew it was going to be intentionally insulting. And if I want to have my identity or existence called into question, I can just watch the news.
I'm interested in what you said a few moments ago about, you know, he probably owes me some thousands in publicity. And, you know, I'm not naive. I spend a little bit of time on the Twitter machine. And I think there are those, and you're not naive either, right, who claim that it's the opposite, that you are trying to make your career from writing about Dave Chappelle. You want to respond to that?
I do. So in the last 48, 72 hours, a lot of transgender writers and social media folk have been banned from our platforms or locked out of our platforms. I currently have no access to my main Instagram account. What Dave Chappelle achieved with his most recent special was a battle cry. It was a rallying cry for transphobes to come out of the woodwork and troll and bully and pressure transgender people to not speak, because Dave Chappelle is allowed to have absolutely any opinion. This is the argument they constantly make. You know, if you don't like Dave's opinions, then you don't have to listen. And yet they'll spend hours a day berating transgender people into silence for saying, we don't find Dave Chappelle funny anymore.
Is there a way to speak, to have voice, to not be silenced, but also not to have to center Dave Chappelle in your work?
Yeah, and I guess that's really the sticking point for me in all of this, because when people throw that accusation around of we're trying to make names for ourselves on Dave Chappelle's back or whatever, Dave Chappelle has already made $60 million on our lived experiences. He's made $60 million mocking us and calling us into question. And for Black queer people especially, and especially Black trans women, he has erased our existence very intentionally, very skillfully, for $60 million. And we've gotten nothing. So when trans comics only get the spotlight during controversies, I think that's really the issue. If we could reach a point where Netflix was reaching out to transgender comics to, like, have specials expressing the funny side of being trans, that would be fantastic. But if Dave Chappelle's voice is the only voice being heard for what the trans community is or what our experience is, then we are effectively being silenced. The only people being canceled are transgender people.
Dahlia, I want to play you a couple of classic moments in Black comedy.
The devil made me buy this dress. Said I didn't want to buy no dress. The devil kept following me. I was going down the street going, and the devil kept following me, and he kept telling me how good I look.
Oh, my goodness. If it isn't Little Miss Attitude, why are you always over here? I mean, don't you have a bag?
There we're hearing, you know, Flip Wilson, you know, as Geraldine, Martin Lawrence as Shanae. And I realize, you know, I grew up, Dahlia, in this house where what my father would say about moments like that is that these are Black male comedians who are being emasculated by having to wear a dress in order to be considered funny. But as I got older and really started to reflect on this, I thought, you know, maybe that's what's going on. But maybe the bigger issue here is that this is a kind of comedy that's making Black trans women invisible.
Yeah, and that is absolutely true. And applause to you for noticing. Yeah, I was very aware of that growing up. And I don't even want to say it's limited to cisgender, heterosexual Black men. It's really across the board. Like, you can look at movies like Tootsie or, you know, there are any number of titles. An actor appears in a dress eventually, right? Mm-hmm. And I knew from early childhood that that was funny. Or if you had a character who is understood to be a woman, but it turns out they're a man, you know, it's hilarious. Instantly. So yeah, it's very much beats this narrative into young queer people's heads that we are a punchline. And I guess, to be honest, in my opinion, that is why we're so good at telling jokes about ourselves, because we've literally heard every single one. So when a trans comic writes a trans joke, we are thinking, okay, what's the punchline? Why is my existence a joke? But how can I enjoy the joke too?
Mix Dahlia Bell, writer and comedian, thank you for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.